Welcome to the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network with me, Naomi Fowler. Coming up later, 10 years after the crash.
If the crisis has taught us anything, then it is there is an inherent instability in the financial system that we can't really get rid of. So what we really have to do is make sure that the damage that that financial system can do to the rest of us is limited.
We ask what the next crash will look like. But first, here's a quick roundup of this month's Tax Justice news. Britain looks set to continue as a no-questions-asked destination of choice for dirty money. It was reported this month that an alleged mafia money launderer operated a £100 million company in the UK for nearly 5 years, registering names and addresses in Italian that included a director called the Chicken Thief, a profession registered as fraudster, and giving an address of the Street of the 40 Thieves in Alibaba, Italy. Company formation rules clearly not fit for purpose. Still plenty of loopholes that need closing despite recent improvements with the public register of beneficial owners of UK-based companies. And here's another mafia story. According to declassified government documents just released under a 30-year rule in Australia, police warned against approving the now US President Donald Trump's bid to build Sydney's first casino due to his mafia connections. Also in Australia, according to new analysis of 800,000 trusts with assets over 3 trillion Aussie dollars, it's still only a minority sport. The Australia Institute found only just over 0.4% of taxpayers account for 95% of that trust income, and they think the government's losing at least $3.5 billion a year in tax because of trusts alone. One of the big four accountancy firms, PricewaterhouseCoopers, has been fined just over £5 million for audit misconduct. That outdoes its own record fine of £5 million it got only 3 months ago for misconduct over its audit of another company. The Democratic Republic of the Congo is one of the poorest countries in the world, yet one of the richest in natural resources. Global Witness estimates more than $750 million of mining revenues have disappeared from the country over a 3-year period. Guess where that ended up? London? United States? Maybe Switzerland? And speaking of Switzerland, the biggest political party there thinks it can get enough support in Parliament to block the automatic exchange of information of data between it and India, on the basis that India is a corrupt country. The exchange agreement was due to kick in next year. The Swiss People's Party has a long list of other countries they don't want to exchange information with. As regular TaxCast listeners will know, Switzerland's ranked number one in the Tax Justice Network's Financial Secrecy Index. So we have a situation where the corrupt Swiss want to deprive countries of information that had actually helped them tackle the corruption they're accusing them of. That's one to keep an eye on. Those are the Tax Justice headlines. Now we're going to talk to John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network for his take on this month. Okay, John, this month we've got some more big news when it comes to the Panama Papers fallout. We've got another Prime Minister who bites the dust, this time Nawaz Sharif of Pakistan. Large undeclared financial assets abroad, lots of high-end London real estate apparently, owned through trusts by his family members. Pakistan's Supreme Court has ruled him unfit to hold office and ordered a criminal investigation into his family over corruption allegations. And so far, the Sharif family just hasn't been able to account for this huge wealth. By the way, Nawaz Sharif has filed 3 separate appeals in the Supreme Court over this ruling, so he's not going quietly. But I think the point is that, again, we have use of trusts as the vehicle of choice. Again, we should point out that the advances in public registers of beneficial or the real owners of companies still don't include trusts, which is a particularly Anglo-Saxon offering. One of the reasons a cynic might say that the UK has been so enthusiastic about registers of beneficial owners of companies, yet has always sought to exempt trusts.
Well, I think it's right that we focus on trusts as well as offshore companies, because trusts have been used extensively right the way across the British tax haven industry, including, of course, in the British tax havens in the Cayman and British Virgin Islands, Jersey, the Channel Islands, so on. Trusts are the weapon of secrecy because they're not required to be registered. There's no official record on public record of who are the settlors and the beneficiaries. And this means that trusts are open to massive abuse by those who are wanting to use offshore financial services as a means of avoiding disclosure of who they are. And in the case of Sharif, what appears to be in the case is that he's structured his affairs so that his family own London-based property through offshore companies, shell companies based in the British Virgin Islands, with an underlying trust to avoid disclosing any information about how these properties are ultimately owned by a politically exposed person in Pakistan. And this raises really important questions about the role of the what we call enablers, the lawyers who create the trusts and who act as trustees, the accounting firms who also set up these structures, also the estate agents who helped these offshore companies in the British Virgin Islands buy the London property. All of them should have known that the client was a politically exposed person, that is, the president of Pakistan. They should also know that this particular individual, Mr. Sharif, has history, because this is not the first time that he's been caught up in corrupt practices. In fact, he was removed from office in 1993 when he was dismissed by the then president because of reports of mismanagement and corruption around his family businesses. So all of the red lights should have been flashing in London. But the truth of the matter is, this dismissal from office was not because of enablers flashing red lights. It was because of the Panama Papers disclosures via the International Consortium of Domestic Journalists.
Right, and I think it's important to point out as well that despite all his moralising about all this, the head of an opposition party in Pakistan and former cricketer Imran Khan also avoided paying taxes in the UK using an offshore firm. And the same court that's just disqualified Sharif from holding public office for hiding assets is also hearing a petition against Imran Khan seeking his disqualification, alleging non-disclosure of assets, ownership of offshore companies, and receipt of foreign funds for the party. So, also, we've had more Panama Papers fallout this month. The offshore law firm Mossack Fonseca has closed down most of its offices around the world. That's 39 of its 45 offices so far, as criminal charges progress against Mossack and Fonseca themselves in Panama. And there are even rumours that the Panama office will also close. And I mean, this is a victory, isn't it? But let's not get too excited, since there's plenty more offshore law firms to take that business. Nearly all of them are based in the UK or UK Crown dependencies and overseas territories. You may have heard of the offshore magic circle. It's an ill wind that blows no one any good, as they say.
Yeah, I'm sad to say, yes, it sounds like a victory. Mossack Fonseca, the brand, is so tainted, it's unlikely to survive. It's probably the end of it. But that does not mean that the clients will simply pack up and become legitimate. It's more likely that, first of all, the previous offices known as Mossack Fonseca will be rebranded as something else, and the clients who don't want to remain with those offices will migrate to other offshore law firms. And as you say, there are a whole load of offshore law firms. Look up offshore magic circle on a search engine and you'll see them. They're famous, they've been around for many, many years. And all of them, I'm sure, if they had the same kind of disclosures, the leak that Mossack Fonseca suffered, would probably find that their client base is every bit as dodgy, with plenty of high-level politicians, high-level wealthy people, and so on, mainly engaged in tax avoidance and evasion at one level or another. So I think we're just seeing the end of a brand which is now so tainted by the an astonishing success of the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists.
Right, okay, let's move on. There's been a court ruling over a football club in the United Kingdom, which is pretty significant for the rest of the world and again demonstrates how trusts can be abused. Tell us about that one.
Yes, this court ruling involves an attempt by the liquidators of what was previously the Rangers Football Club, which was put into liquidation in 2012. They were fighting a claim by the tax authorities over what are known as employee benefit trusts. And this case, which has been rumbling on for a long time, was taken to the Supreme Court. It's known as the Big Tax case, because these employee benefit trusts are widely used, not just across the British Football League, but by many other companies. What they do is they allow the employer to pay money to an offshore structure. Don't pay it as income to the footballers. They were paying it to an offshore structure, which was then lending the money as a permanent loan to the footballers. The court now has said that this was an entirely false structure. It was clearly income that was being paid, and the employee benefit trusts, which, as I said, happened to be being used widely, not just by Rangers Football Club, but by many other football clubs and other employers, are now deemed to be simply contrivances. And that's really important because, first of all, as you say, rightly, it's yet another abuse of trust arrangements, largely for tax avoidance purposes. It's important because for a long time, many of the accounting firms and law firms were pushing these to other employers, saying, well, widely used, it's now become legitimate and so on. It clearly isn't. And I think this is the end of the employee benefit trusts. It's probably the end of a massive contrived tax avoidance scheme, which has been going on for decades.
Okay, right. Also in the UK, we've had really an incredible speech 10 years after the financial crash from the Governor of the Bank of England, Mark Carney. Incredibly, he's predicted in this speech that Britain's financial sector could double in size in the next 25 years. And it's as though he's never heard of the finance curse. Perhaps he hasn't.
Well, maybe, perhaps he hasn't, but some of his officials have certainly been warning or been well aware of the fact that hosting an oversized financial sector is not good for the general economy. And that's clearly the case in Britain, because Britain is perhaps one of the worst examples across the world of the damage caused by hosting an oversized financial services sector. Hosting the City of London has led to a massively overvalued currency for decades, and this has had a terrible impact on other sectors of the economy, which have simply found that they could not compete because sterling has been so overvalued. But it also means that far too many of Britain's brightest graduates have headed into the City of London rather than going into other productive sectors, which means that Britain now has a huge deficit of innovators, entrepreneurs, leaders, call them what you will, in other sectors. It means that the City of London has been attracting huge amounts, not of productive investment, but portfolio investment. I mean, I think back to the Sharif case. They weren't investing in a factory or anything, making anything useful. They were investing in London property, which by and large stood empty for most of the time. So much of this portfolio investment also involves mergers and acquisitions, which doesn't help create new jobs or improve productivity, or investment in shares, which simply boosts the stock values of companies without actually improving productivity in the slightest. So the idea that this is good news for Britain and that Citi creates new jobs, it doesn't create new jobs. It hasn't created any new jobs at all for decades. Or tax revenues. One thing we learned from the financial crash 10 years ago is that when banks need bailout, they need bailouts in the hundreds of billions. So the idea that this is contributing huge tax revenue to Britain has to be challenged. The Bank of England's comments come across as highly complacent and utterly wrong.
John Christensen of the Tax Justice Network. Now it's time for the TaxCast special feature. 10 years after the financial crash, we ask, what might the next crash look like? Can we avoid it? How do we shift the outdated thinking that led to all the trouble in the first place? Things change all the time. Yet we're still looking at economics and finance using old glasses, not bothering to get our eyesight tested. I'm talking today to Professor of Political Arithmetic at the University of Amsterdam, Daniel Mugger. Okay, so the narrative is quite strong that we've fixed everything now, that banks have a capital base 3 times stronger now, the regulators are on top of all these issues. What would you say?
Well, unfortunately, I'd have to disagree. You know, the standard narrative of this crisis has really identified 3 core villains, and those were bankers who had become reckless because they had outsized incentives, you know, bonuses effectively to take huge risks, regulators who were asleep at the wheel because they trusted banks too much to get things right, and you had an extremely opaque financial system in which nobody really knew what anybody else was doing, and these 3 ingredients combined were responsible for the crisis. Now, if that's your main story of the crisis, then you could say then there's actually some good news, because I think on all 3 of those counts, we have actually seen some progress. You know, regulators are much more alert now than they were 10 years ago. Financial companies have rejigged their incentive structures, and some of the most opaque corners of the financial system have been cleared out, have been cleaned up a bit. So you could say, well, we've made serious progress there.
Right, but you think that that analysis misses what was at the heart of the crisis itself.
Yes, unfortunately, I think that this basic narrative portrays the crisis as one of the financial sector. You know, it says it was the financial institutions themselves who weren't functioning properly, and now they function much better, and so we're good. I, in contrast, would say that this was a crisis of the financial system as a whole, where a mountain of debt had accumulated. In this case, yes, largely in derivatives that were tied to American subprime mortgage markets, but nevertheless, in the system, a pile of debt had accumulated, and just by piling on more debt and more debt and more debt, did that way of doing things look sustainable? And then when things eventually came crashing down, we found out that there was way too much debt and too little of a fundament to support that. Now, once you think that a debt overload is the problem and too much optimism and trust, if you combine that with a big societal reliance that we still have on debt and debt levels in many sectors that are back to where they were around 2007, 2008, then I think we have absolutely not gotten over the crisis, but we may have just seen the setting of the stage for our next one.
Okay, tell us a bit more about what you mean when you talk about debt.
Yes, of course, you know, people will always need access to credit to finance things in their lives, which they can then pay back later once they've had another 10 or 20 years of income. I think that's perfectly fine. I think what's the problem is if we just keep extending this debt financing to ever more domains of our societies, and I think financing education is a good example of that. You know, education wasn't a sector that was completely reliant on debt a few decades ago. Now it is, both on the side of the universities, but also on the side of the students. So there was a move there that was not inevitable, but it was a political choice to push things that way. And so I think that can be reversed. And the other thing is that if, as a society, for the way that the economic system as a whole ticks, we've become dependent on increasing levels of debt, whether that's on the private side, on the government side, on the corporate side, wherever, then I think we have a problem. So it's not that there is debt at all in our lives, but the question is, do we have a systemic dependence on it? Are we in trouble if we were to cut that back? And if that's the case, then I think, you know, we need to take a hard look at our economic model that we're running in our society. The other way of relying on debt is the role that financial centers, such as the City of London, play in our economies. This is often fairly far removed from our everyday lives. Much of the money that's sloshing around there doesn't have to do with credit cards or loans for your latest car or something like that. But these are often deals between financial institutions that run through opaque offshore financial centers and these sorts of things. And also there, we've learned through the crisis that there is a real danger to our societies and economies when that comes crashing down. Remember that there are trillions and trillions of debt just being pushed around every day within the financial sector. Now, the value added of that kind of activity to our societies may be limited. The reason why we still have it is because that activity does generate a lot of profits for the institutions involved. And to the degree that host governments can skim off even a little bit of those corporate profits, they're, of course, eager to have these institutions within their jurisdiction. And I think that's what's going on, that I can see how governments think that this is, on the short term, useful for them to host these kinds of activities, even though the danger that they continue to pose for societies, I think, are quite substantial. If the crisis has taught us anything, then it is that there are limits to the degree of how safe we can make our financial system.
Right, and we can't just solve this by having more regulations to fit what went wrong last time. I mean, the idea is that governments must and can protect us, but you're saying there's a limit to what they can actually do for us.
Well, see, you know, that's one of the ironies of the learning process that we've gone through after the financial crisis. On the one hand, many people came to the conclusion that letting market players do all the pricing, valuation, and risk assessment themselves, which is what they did in the run-up to the financial crisis, is a lot less safe than people had assumed beforehand. On the other hand, you know, the fact that markets can't really get it right doesn't mean that governments can. People quickly jumped to the conclusion at the time that what we would need would be much more heavy-handed intervention by public authorities, say, for example, something like a public rating agency or much more stringent accounting standards or some kind of macroprudential rules that would tell financial markets effectively, you know, where they are in the financial cycle between boom and bust. But then over the years, we found that for public authorities, it's just as difficult as it is for market players to say with certainty, oh, you know, this is where we are. This is the appropriate value of government debt for this or that country. This is the appropriate accounting standard for some weird derivative. So nobody really knows where we are. We now found out through the crisis that market actors can't be trusted to know for sure. But we've also, I think, learned that public authorities also can't really do the job. So they've always drawn back a little bit from actually sort of, you know, picking up the gauntlet and then deciding instead of markets what the appropriate policies here and now are. So I guess the bigger lesson to be learned from that is not that, okay, markets screwed up, so it's time for public authorities to take on that job, but that there is an inherent instability in the financial system that we can't really get rid of. So what we really have to do is make sure that the damage that that financial system, when it comes crashing down, as it does periodically, can do to the rest of us is limited.
Okay, and that brings us to the question of the Tax Justice Network's concept of the finance curse, over-reliance on oversized finance sectors, something we've talked about a lot on the TaxCast. You say rather than thinking we can avoid another crisis, we should be thinking about downsizing finance so it can't do us as much damage when it does crash. And the supposed benefits of these large financial centres are really questionable anyway. There isn't enough research or even accurate or appropriate measures being used to actually assess its real value to economies and societies.
Well, I think that's a very good point, because the way that we normally look at these kinds of activities is basically by asking, you know, what is their contribution to GDP? And from that, we say, well, this is a significant chunk of economic activity in the UK or in the Netherlands or wherever else. But the way that GDP measures for these kinds of activities work is actually, you know, quite problematic, because what these measures do is they either reason backwards. They say, what are the profits that are being earned in the sector? And then implied by that, you know, what does that suggest about the value of the quote unquote product that has been produced here, such that the financial sector has been able to generate these kinds of profits, right? So there is a backward kind of reason, because we can't actually observe the price tags of many financial services, you know, say that interest differential between people who put in deposits and the people who take out a loan. So the way that we gauge the value of the financial sector is looking at profits that are generated there and then seeing what the implied value of the product must have been if they were able to generate these profits. That's a highly questionable way of judging what the contribution of a financial sector is. Just that they're able to generate huge profits doesn't necessarily mean that there's any real quote-unquote value in the products that they're generated there. I'm sure there is some value there, but there are other activities that generate profits actually on the back of other activities. And, you know, for all I know, there are some activities that we shouldn't add to GDP, but because of the risks that they generate, might rather be subtracted from it. What I think we do see is that the City of London has become an integral part of the growth model of the United Kingdom. And certainly in a day and age where there is a lot of uncertainty around, of course, in the wake of the decision for Brexit, but also because we face a future of relatively low economic growth, there is still a high debt burden that we've inherited from the financial crisis. If the city is an integral part of the current growth model, I don't think that many officials and politicians feel huge appetite to rock the boat in that respect, you know, to basically, you know, cut off the hand that they feel is feeding the British economy.
So by taking measures to downsize finance, what would all these banks and financial services do instead? I mean, do they know how to do anything else?
I think the implication of cutting the financial sector down to size would indeed be that quite a few people there would find themselves with very little to do. Now, I think it's fair to say at the same time that the advances in computer technology, I think, put pressure on quite a few of the things that people in the financial sector do anyway. As we know, a lot of trading in all kinds of assets, you know, obviously stocks, but also other kinds of securities, has been automated already. And for all we know, the computers and the algorithms, they certainly don't do a worse job, barring the occasional crash, than their human counterparts did. So as far as these kinds of things are concerned, I think we already see quite a lot of pressure on financial sector jobs. If you were to cut the financial sector down to size further, and now not because of technological developments, but because of social and societal demands, considerations, yes, I think the truth is that quite a few people would find themselves without something to do in the City of London, in Canary Wharf. But quite frankly, at the same time, I think that people who work there are often highly educated, you know, have pretty versatile skill set, and, you know, in an age of computerization and big data, you know, if you've your physics PhD worked in the City of London, I don't think you'll have a very hard time finding an alternative job at Google or one of the myriad other IT high-tech companies that also rely on this kind of automated technology.
Okay, so they'll be all right. So how do you go about stopping the debt finance monster, though?
Our societies have become so reliant on this debt merry-go-round that cutting that down to size would also seem to carry some dangers. Denting our over-reliance on debt, of course, is a double-edged sword. It's not something that you can do without actually implementing other major reforms. And I think that's a point where the discussion actually gets much bigger than, you know, what's right or wrong about the financial system, but what's our way of achieving a balanced economy. And if debt has its systemic and systematic dangers for our societies, then I think we have to retake a hard look at the obvious alternative, and that's, you know, a much stronger form of redistribution. Right now, the system basically works on the haves lending money to the have-nots, among other things, to keep that economic motor running, the engine. The alternative would be that the haves don't lend the money to the have-nots, but that they actually give it, like it or not, to the have-nots, because then you also get a balancing and you can sustain the aggregate demand without having in the back of all of this, this ever-increasing mountain of debt.
One of many visionary ideas circulating for a long time is that of a citizen's basic income. The state giving money to citizens is currently being trialled in several places around the world. When people hear a proposal like that for the first time, they're kind of shocked at the audacity of it. And yet governments give handouts to big business and to the extremely wealthy through tax breaks, subsidies and incentives all the time, and no one even blinks. It just goes to show how far we have yet to travel to shift economic understanding. But a rethinking of economic ideas is well underway.
We have to recognise we're in a straitjacket, because actually it's an invisible straitjacket. We have to recognise it, and then we have to break out of it.
Economist Henry Leveson-Gower of Promoting Economic Pluralism.
I see it as a social movement, ultimately, along similar lines to the feminist movement, gay movement, to the transgender movement. Because what it is ultimately about is changing how we think, the language we use, the way we understand the world. And the first stage is actually understanding that our language, our thought, our imagination has been constrained and narrowed and limited by the framework that has been so dominant for the last 30 years.
That's why 10 years after the last crash, promoting economic pluralism has brought together a wide coalition of people to develop and design a fairer, more sustainable and resilient economic system. A whole series of events are beginning soon, some of which will be made available online.
We have taken on the whole story narrative of mainstream economics. It's not just an analytical thing that happens behind closed doors in universities. It's actually gone out and taken over the way the world is seen. And people have become totally used to it. It's just the way we think. And so first we have to realize how it is constraining our thinking, how it means that someone like Trump can stand up and say, smart people don't pay tax. And people can think that that is actually a reasonable statement to make. So we have to actually escape from that and then start forging new languages, new images, new ways of seeing the world that can actually allow us to create a fairer, more sustainable and more resilient economic system. It's a pretty big ask, but only by bringing people together, by working together and building a community, building an understanding of how we all need to change. This is personal as well as political. Can we actually get to where we need to be?
Can we afford not to? You can find out more about the 10 Years After the Crash events on www.10yearsafterthecrash.com. That's 10 in numbers. Promoting Economic Pluralism's websites, www.economicpluralism.org, and Professor of Political Arithmetic at the University of Amsterdam, Daniel Mugger's fascinating site is www.fickleformulas.org. We'll be talking on the TaxCast again soon with Professor Mugger on how weak and out of data our economic measurement tools are. But that's it for now. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next month.